Maine's museums step up to big challenges during COVID-19. Summer is prime time for what might be called the backbone of Maine's cultural life, its network of extraordinary museums, from art to history to culture. Large and small and tiny, Maine's museums serve more than 2.7 million visitors each year. Their exhibits and special events not only attract tourists, but also serve as anchors for their communities. But COVID has been a real challenge for them, both financially and existentially. Just what are museums for? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will talk with some of the creative people running museums in Maine right now about how they've stepped up to this moment and worked to continue to serve their audience. Maine Calling is next. But first, this news update. For Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Museums exist for visitors, but the pandemic shut down visitation for months. Now that restrictions are loosening, museums are coming up with safe ways to serve their audiences, and we're going to discuss some of these creative solutions during this hour. Joining me, Julie Butcher-Pizzino. She is Executive Director of the Children's Museum and Theater of Maine, and Bernard Fishman, Director of the Maine State Museum. We'll have other calls from other museums during the hour as well. And as always, we want to hear from you. Have you visited any museums recently? Have you done any virtual visits or activities outside of the traditional museum structure? How do museums matter to you? You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Julie and Bernard, I know both of your museums have unique situations right now. We'll talk about those in a minute. But first, I just want to talk about some general challenges. Julie, I'll start with you. Tell us about the challenges that museums faced when the COVID pandemic began shutting things down. And how, as a children's museum, things were even more difficult.
Sure. Thank you, Jennifer, and thanks for having me. It has certainly been a remarkable time and one filled with challenges, but I think a lot of silver linings, and we're learning new and different and innovative ways to do our work. But the reality is, as you said early on, we are a visitor-based institution. So we have been closed since March 13th, and still waiting to get the green light to reopen from the state of Maine. So that has meant for us that we have moved all of our efforts online primarily through a variety of initiatives, from daily live streaming throughout the course of the spring to new programming. We developed a playwright festival. We developed a kid newscast show, all things that we can do without being together in person. As you pointed out, as a children's museum, this is particularly difficult for us because we love being together in person. It's kind of why we exist in many ways. And so it has certainly been a challenge to think about new ways that we'll do our work when we will be able to reopen. And we're already starting to consider that now as we look towards the future. But overall, certainly, we've had some tough challenges to face, particularly in terms of our staffing. We have had some full furloughs and partial furloughs of team members just to try to keep our costs down. We're just continuing to work towards, making sure that we can stick to a good bottom line while remaining closed and waiting to reopen.
Yeah, and I'm thinking for both of your museums, Julie and Bernard, one of the unfortunate ironies is there are so many parents out there right now who would love to be able to be bringing their kids to your museums. Bernard, how was the Maine State Museum affected?
Well, fairly seriously, and we have an additional problem which you and the audience may or may not know about. We reopened after being closed for 3 months in June after a great deal of physical changes to the building to make it safer, and quarantine restrictions of one sort or another. And we began to get about 20% of the expected audience back. And then we had a massive breakdown of all of the mechanical systems in our building. And so we had to shut down again because we lost our air conditioning. There are three state agencies in our building, the State Library, ourselves, the State Museum, and the State Archives. So we have all been closed, and the state feels that it must close the so-called cultural building where our three agencies are for an extended period of time to do these repairs. So we are going to be closed for quite a long time, and that intensifies everything else. It raises many questions about the purpose of museums, what we can do, how do you support yourself. As with Julie, we've developed numbers of online programs that are new, including a pandemic primary source set for schools and teachers. Before we closed, the Maine State Museum had the largest school program of any museum in Maine, and we were getting about 15,000 school students on site, and our total attendance was about 45,000. And we were known for our exhibits, and that's all past now. Mm-hmm. So we have a whole range of online programming. As with Julie, we have some silver linings, but they're kind of behind the curtain. I can certainly talk about them. But this is not just for our museum because we had to close due to the building problems, but this is certainly the most serious setback for museums that has existed, in my opinion, in the modern world, certainly in my lifetime.
Mm. And Bernard, how long will these repairs force your building to be closed? Do you know?
It's not entirely clear, but it could be 2 years.
Oh, my goodness.
And, yes, right. So I become the poster child for maintaining museum activity and work when access to the public is limited. And we have many ideas about school programs and greater outreach, and are implementing some of them and will implement more of them. But there's an enormous amount of museum work to do that the public never sees. And a museum functions, at least visibly, you might say, like an iceberg. The tip of that iceberg, even when, like the Maine State Museum, you have almost 50,000 square feet of exhibits, is only the tip of an enormous iceberg of collections care and management and acquisition and publication and research that goes on at an intensive rate and is needed to support everything else. We have a collection of possibly 800,000 objects, 200,000 just in history, not including archaeology, not including natural history. And these have to be taken care of and cataloged and made available for research. And this opportunity gives us the chance to do intensive, deep cataloging to match that with our new database, to do much more research on these things. But this isn't just esoteric or academic, because one of the things that this virus emergency is going to force us to do is to really reimagine a lot of the museum. And I'm not thinking so much of online information, although that will be part of it. But when we come back, what kinds of exhibits should we have? What should we be displaying to the public? We're probably going to have to dismantle, we don't know yet, but at least a quarter of the exhibits in the building. And
most of
those will be replaced.
Bernard,
yes.
The work that's going on behind the scenes, the archiving, the care, is this happening in an unair-conditioned building, or have you brought refrigerated trucks up and moved things to other places?
In an unair-conditioned building, we've had some pretty interesting temperatures. It's a very complex process. It's being managed by the Bureau of, so the acronym is BGS in state government. They are trying to be as helpful as possible. So we have many dehumidifiers. We have some portable air conditioners. But it's mainly meant an adjustment of work policy, much more flexibility about people working from home or in other spaces. We do have collection storage off-site a couple of miles from the main museum building where conditions are much better. So there's quite a rotation, and we're all adjusting to that while also sustaining or trying to sustain the need to keep the staff collaborative, working together, at least within Zoom meeting sight of each other, and because one of our strengths was the way in which the staff worked together. I've been a museum director for 36 years, and the staff here has a level of excellent collaboration which I haven't seen matched in any other museum I've been involved with. So a lot of good things were going on and working to sustain them, but being flexible about people's needs and making sure that the heat conditions aren't a danger for staff. These are all on top of the virus, on top of everything else. So there's a lot going on.
Julie, I know that the Children's Museum of Maine had big plans, building a great big new museum down at Thompson's Point. What has the pandemic meant to, for that?
Great question. And the good news is we've already mentioned silver linings a couple of times, but certainly our new building is a huge silver lining for us in this pandemic. We are certainly glad that we weren't planning to open this March. We are still hoping that we will be opening in early 2021. And the construction continues, and I'm very grateful and pleased to say that it has not really been affected by the pandemic. If you're driving down 295, we've actually had quite a few folks say, "Oh, I didn't realize that was your building." But it is, in fact, our building, the towering building that you see kind of rising up from Thompson's Point off of 295. And we are on schedule. So we're incredibly excited to have this gift to Maine to look forward to, a place for children to play and learn. And in line with the challenges of the pandemic, we're also grateful that this is a new state-of-the-art building. So we are in a lucky position to be able to plan now for what things will look like when we do open back up to the public. And as Bernard mentioned, we know things will be different. It undoubtedly will take some time for life to come back to normal, but we know that kids are going to need to play and to play together as soon as it's humanly possible. And you mentioned parents, and parents are going to need that too. So we're very excited to open up the building with a brand new slate of exhibits that in large part are, as we've been saying internally, kind of more COVID friendly. We will have new cleaning protocols. We will have more touchless systems for entry. We're in a unique position as one of the only cultural institutions that is opening a new building in New England over the next year or two to kind of come to this with very fresh eyes and think about what a children's museum and theater of the future can and should look like. So we're certainly still facing plenty of challenges now, as all museums across Maine and beyond are, as Bernard also pointed out. But we're also very hopeful for the future and looking forward to opening the doors of that new building sometime early next year.
Calling in now, Suzette McAvoy, who is Executive Director of the Center for Maine Contemporary Art. Thanks for joining us, Suzette.
You're welcome. I'm happy to be on the call.
Tell me how CMCA was affected by the pandemic.
Well, like other museums in Maine, CMCA closed to the public in mid-March and only recently reopened on July 1. But throughout this time, we've been very fortunate not to lay off any staff, thanks to having received a payroll protection loan in the early round. But the loss of income due to closure has required deep cuts in our operating budget, including canceling, you know, major social events, fundraising events, and pushing forward our exhibitions that we had planned. We had a number of exhibitions planned in conjunction with the Bicentennial of Maine, which are now going to be taking place next summer. But we also have, course, even though we've reopened, are seeing a steep decline in attendance. I think as an indication, last July we had over 1,500 visitors, and this July 1 we had 6. So in that same day a year ago, there was that dramatic change in visitation.
Do you think that people don't know that you're open, or do you think that people are just still not going indoors generally?
I think that's really it. We're just not seeing the visitors here in the Midcoast, in Rockland, in the downtown. And of course, with the curtailing of First Fridays, which were a really large community-wide event and brought in lots of visitors to Rockland, we are, that's corresponding in lack of visitation here at CMCA, and of course, loss of income to the other businesses, hotels, and restaurants in the area.
Suzette, I understand you're retiring. Congratulations. What do you hope is next for the museum?
Well, I think that this is going to be an interesting time as we go forward. I think that all of us are embracing, you know, virtual programming and looking at ways that we can actually expand and reach new audiences through our online programming. We're fortunate here at CMCA that we've been making virtual tours of all of our exhibits since fall of 2018. So we already had a good platform in place to expand on. But this time has allowed us to do a lot of projects that we just haven't had the opportunity to or the time to, because we've always been working on the next exhibition. But working on that platform of virtual tours, we've added downloadable lesson plans to them so we can conduct classroom visits via Zoom. We added audio guides to the virtual tour, so now visitors can go online and actually download a tour by myself or another curator, or even hear the artist in conjunction with the virtual tour.
Well, Suzette, thank you so much for calling in. You're breaking up a little bit, so I'm going to say goodbye. But that was Suzette McAvoy with the Center for Maine Contemporary Art. Thanks for calling in and congratulations on your retirement. Before we go to a break, though, we're going to go to Joel, who's calling from York. Hi, Joel. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call, Jennifer. I'm Joel Lefevre, the director of the Old York Historical Society. And we've had many of the same experiences that all of our other colleagues have been having. We've really, though, been working on trying to find ways that we can engage our local community, because, of course, they're the ones that really do support us year-round. And we're pretty excited that we have walking tours that folks can come on. We also did instead of a fundraising dinner where people gathered, a boxed gourmet dinner that we delivered to folks, and they were so happy. They said, "We're tired of cooking at home."
And, that's a fun idea.
It's been great to see our members still rallying around the museum, and you know, we'll be able to open at some point, but this is just with our small buildings, it just hasn't been the time that we can do that.
Well, Joel, thanks so much for calling in. And we have a note here from Lisa on Facebook. Castine Historical Society is offering twice daily walking tours of our amazing historic town. They've been going very well and seemed a safe way to teach history to locals and visitors. And she says, learn more at castinehistoricalsociety.org. And what I'll say to Joel, you, and to Lisa, and anybody else who's with an organization and wants to share information like that, go on to today's Facebook post and put that in the comment section. And we'll have a little bit of a resource right there. We're talking about museums in Maine during COVID on Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Breakwater, offering summer day camp programs for ages 3 to 18 through August 21st, enrichment.breakwaterlearning.org, by Patriot Subaru with a mission to serve customers, families, community, and each other. Learn more at patriotsubaru.com. And Maine Coast Heritage Trust, celebrating 50 years of land conservation leadership. Join today at mcht.org.
For millions of listeners, public radio is about stories that bring the news home. Some listen for arts, others politics, but everyone listens for reliable information when our country faces a big challenge. From the 1971 Vietnam protests...
For these young Americans, today was a major test of their commitment to the ethical code of the young and the angry. It was their Freedom Ride, their Selma March, their May Day.
To Watergate...
A resolution to impeach President Nixon was introduced in the House today by Massachusetts Democrat Robert Drinan.
And how COVID-19 is altering our lives in countless ways.
A lot of our customers are coming in masks, and I appreciate that. And I like to think it's not just for their own health, but it's for ours.
You rely on public radio for news and analysis you can trust. Here's how you can support it.
Our summer supporter drive, Pledge from Home, starts tomorrow, or you can pledge right now at mainepublic.org. Thanks.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, how are museums in Maine faring these days? Joining me, Bernard Fishman, who's director of the Maine State Museum, and Julie Pizzino, executive director of the Children's Museum and Theater of Maine. We invite you to be part of the conversation. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Calling in now, Mark Basir, who's director of the Portland Museum of Art. Thanks for joining us, Mark.
Hi, Jennifer. How are you?
I'm good. Tell us what the Portland Museum of Art did when you had to close to visitors. Were you still able to offer options?
We were, Jennifer. I just want to mention that I'm actually calling from the wonderful Monhegan Museum, and my friend Jen Pyle, the co-director's office, and the Monhegan Museum is also open. Even though there's only 5 visitors allowed in the gallery at a time, they've got a great show here. You know, the PMA has been open now for about 6 weeks, and we're seeing about, let's say, 100 to 150 people coming each day.
What would be a usual day in the summertime?
That would be the bottom. We would be looking at 300, 350, and hoping for up to 2,500 to 3,000 on a Friday night. So
are
our
you
earned revenue,
yeah.
We anticipated 200,000 visitors this year, and we are not going to come anywhere close to that. And like the rest of my colleagues, our real pain is on the earned revenue side, like the rest of Maine. We're a strong institution, and what we're thinking about mostly right now is kind of what's next. You know, we want to be thinking about what the museum's going to look like after the COVID crisis, and also aware of the social justice movement that's taking place. We feel very strongly that museums are going to be very different in 6 months, a year, or 2 years, having to do with the protests around social justice and also issues of climate crisis and the virus.
You mentioned that with so few people, that affects finances. Has the museum had to make adjustments? Have you had to lay people off?
You know, we have not done that. What we had to do was really scale our museum hours down from having normally 7 days a week in the summertime. We're down to 5 hours a week, and we're open 12 to 6 3 days and 12 to 8 on 2 other days. In so many ways, it's about keeping our staff safe while they're working and being sure our visitors are safe, to have more time for cleaning, taking care, and just being sure everybody has a relaxed atmosphere. So our only really changes have been in having to limit the hours that we have that we're open.
Mm-hmm. And I understand you had some really big shows planned. Are those still going to happen?
They are. We have a Homer Remington show we've been planning for 4 years. It was installed and ready to open in Denver in March. And we're also partnering with the Amon Carter in Texas. The three of us looked at the schedule and then divvied up the dates, divided it by 3, and we're all going to get it for about 8 to 10 weeks. And so we opened that show September 24th, running through Thanksgiving. We had hoped to open it, as you can imagine, July 4th weekend.
And are you going to have to limit how many people can come at once to see that?
Absolutely. Under the regulations right now, the state of Maine, our open buildings are about 20,000 square feet, which allows us about 100 people in the building at one time. We do think there's a possibility for those numbers to increase, as Maine has been doing very well, but most important is to be sure everyone is safe.
Well, thanks so much for calling in, Mark. I'm a little envious that you're on Monhegan right now. I hope the storm isn't too
bad. Bring your family over.
Wow. That was Mark Basir, director of the Portland Museum of Art. We're going to go now to Chris Newell, who's calling in from the Abbey Museum, where he's executive director. Thanks so much for calling in.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Oh, of course. I know that this is really the busy time, August, for the Abbey Museum. What is the situation there now?
Current situation is we are not open to the public yet. There's a
a little bit too much restriction on the number of people and also the availability of materials that we would need to open, hand sanitizing stations and those types of things have once again become scarce in the supply chain. So we're on basically a two-week assessment cycle. Every 2 weeks we reassess how ready we might be to open based on a lot of factors, not just other museums that are open, but we're looking at specifically at MDI, also the amount of people that we have go through there, which is one of the biggest factors that's kind of holding at the moment.
Oh, Chris, you're cutting out a little bit. I'll try to ask you another question. Hope it works. Is that, we've talked to you a couple months ago about how you made the popular Indian Marketplace into a virtual event. What else have you been able to do to connect with people while the doors have been closed?
So it's interesting when it comes to connection with the doors closed. We had our education staff. They were working on some projects on Glooskap stories that were put on Vermont. And of course, we were also able to transfer our Wabanaki student art show to an online exhibit, and we put that up on our Facebook page, which got a significant amount of traffic. And the great part about it, it wasn't as good as putting the students' art up on display, because it's a special feeling, to have your art.
Shoot, I think we're losing you. Chris, I really appreciate you calling in, though. Chris Newell, Executive Director of the Abbey Museum, of course, up in Bar Harbor. We'll go to Nemo, who's calling from Stew Ben. Hi, Nemo. Go ahead.
Hi. Can you hear me?
I can.
Oh, okay. I've had some experience with museum catalogs. Now, I know the volume that can be done by the State Museum is relatively low compared to major museums, but it's a great way of spotlighting A, the collection, and B, spotlighting some main artists. You can also have reproducible stuff, ceramic mugs, ceramic dinnerware, that are editions. There's somebody around here who makes bronze bells. They can do a special edition for the museum, and that sort of thing. It's a way of keeping your name alive, keeping your collection interesting, and making a little money.
Well, that's a great suggestion, and I'm sure that the art museum directors listening right now appreciate it. And Nemo, it's so nice to hear from you today. Bernard, have you thought about doing creative things to raise money for the museum, given the situation you're in?
Well, first let me respond very briefly to the recent caller. The Maine State Museum has a collection survey book called A Story of Maine and 112 Objects. It's recent. I edited it. So people who still want to get a sense of the key objects in the museum should go to that book, which I think is a popular one and has wonderful illustrations and text. We are eagerly applying for various grants from all sorts of sources, and we get about 80% of our budget from the state. And, of course, that's a concern to us because the state itself is suffering, as we know, from lowered income from many sources. And so we are eagerly awaiting the governor's release of her budget guidelines, which should occur this month, to see how much of a cut we will undergo. But there are many emergency programs that have been developed by enterprises in Washington, national museum organizations, the National Endowment for the Humanities and for the Arts, and the Institute of Museum and Library Services, offering emergency grants. But while they're actually fairly substantial in a national scope, the money in terms of individual museums can be relatively small, and the grant giving, because there's so many applications, is also small. Only about 13% of the applicants to the recent NEH Emergency Museum funding project were successful. According to the American Alliance of Museums, the National Museum Organization, there are 35,000 museums in the United States. I think that's rather optimistic, and that counts so many very small organizations, but especially since only a couple of years ago, the Museum Alliance was projecting 17,000 museums, but there are a huge number of museums in the country. Maine has about 250, and that includes almost any institution that has some kind of public attendance. So I think a lot of what we've been talking about and skirting around, and we're all very active with these many programs, the programs themselves don't bring in a lot of money if they're online. And that can cover a gap, it can bridge a gap, but most museums need regular income, and all of those who love culture and love museums should think about that, should think about supporting their institutions. Of course, there are many competitors, but it is a crisis time. There was an article recently reporting a survey that was undertaken in conjunction with the American Alliance of Museums that predicted one-third of all of American museums will go out of business by next year because of the COVID-19
Boy,
crisis.
I hope that's not true. I'm going to go to an email from Becca, and I'll put this one to you first, Julie. What are museums in Maine doing in relation to the movement to decolonize museums? What are they doing to adequately repair relationships with those who have been frequently harmed by museums and the gaze of museums onto more disadvantaged people, such as poor people, Black, Indigenous, people of color, immigrants, and LGBTQI people? And it's a shame that we had to say goodbye to the folks from the Abbey Museum, because really they are leaders in this movement. But Julie, how, as the Children's Museum is reimagining not only the exhibits, but how you interface with the public, is the Children's Museum adjusting to the present moment?
Well, that is a great question, and I want to thank the sender for that email. It's a critical question, and I also agree with you. I have to give a shout out to my colleague Star Kelly over at the Abbey Museum, because she has done some incredible research and work around this. She speaks about it all over the state of Maine and beyond. So I would encourage encourage anyone who has not heard her speak or looked into the work that the Abbey Museum has done around decolonization of museums to really educate yourself and seek opportunities to do that. At the museum and theater, yes, 100%, this has been a big part of the conversation as we look towards what a children's museum and theater of the future looks like. One thing that we talk a lot about, especially when we think about kids visiting museums and interacting there, is that we are not only working with kids. No kid comes to a children's museum by themselves. They come with a caregiver or a parent. So it's an opportunity to provide education to the entire family and all of our visitors. We've really talked a lot about belonging, the term belonging, and kind of what it means to belong in a community. And I think often, historically, museums have not been a place that that all folks in our society have felt like they belonged in, that they don't see themselves in. And we're working very hard to instill that sense of belonging for everyone in our community, regardless of their background, where they come from, their socioeconomic status. We're really thinking about our programming museum and theater wide. So when we're talking about identity and access and inclusion and diversity, yes, of course, we have spaces where we might focus work on those issues. But in fact, if we are truly going to decolonize and also invite everyone in to feel a sense of belonging, that work has to happen across the entire museum and theater, both internally and externally. And so that's deep work, it's hard work, it's long-term work, but it's absolutely critical work. And I think when we consider what happens after COVID, as my colleague Mark said, yes, of course, we have to think about cleaning and, you know, timed entry and ticketed entry, but we also have to think about access and inclusion and belonging. And I think that is what will help museums and theaters survive post-pandemic, is in ensuring that we're inclusive and accessible to all.
Bernard?
This is going to be a very important matter for museums now and in the future. As I mentioned earlier in the program, one of the silver linings in this otherwise somewhat dark cloud for the Maine State Museum is the opportunity to really rethink a lot of exhibits that are going to be replaced. Not the wonderful core exhibits like the St. Mary or the Speer Mill, but many others. And we will be paying great attention to the question of greater cultural association and access as we think about these museums. It's a wonderful opportunity for us and makes me personally very excited as we think about what the museum can do. We have, as I've already said, these enormous history, archaeology, and environmental collections, and they all relate to the questions of new recognition of the contribution of many peoples and the difficulties and discrimination that is now, I think, much more accepted by those who understand and examine history. So it's a wonderful chance for us to replace, in some cases, exhibits that are 40 years old, and we'll approach these subjects in a much more thoughtful, inclusive, accessible, and contemplative way, because our work is to make the past serve the present and the future. Our historical collections are unrivaled. They can tell many, many stories, and we're particularly interested, as most museums are, more and more in personal stories. And so being able to tell about the past, justice and injustice, relating it to what's going on now and how we can make the future a much better future for us all is part of what a museum has to do. We provide an aspect of identity for all people in Maine and all people who come to Maine. Any state museum does that. It's part of our job to help shape that identity and not just reflect it. And a lot is going on in our culture. Again, for me, it's the perhaps the most fervent cultural moment in my own lifetime in this country. And so there'll be many opportunities to, I think, help shape our understanding of what it means to be a Mainer from Maine or visiting Maine, and incorporating many new contemporary outlooks with that view towards making a new way of looking at the future. It's an incredibly important opportunity for us.
We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your questions and comments. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from the Cedars, a nonprofit senior living community in Portland since 1929, offering independent living at the Atrium, thecedarsportland.org, and Rooster Brother, the store for cooks and those who love them, at the Union River Bridge in downtown Ellsworth.
On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
On August 4, 1818, the day after the Cumberland Bank in Portland was robbed of $200,000, approximately $4 million today, a $10,000 reward was offered for information on the culprit and the return on the sum stolen. Portland at the time was a small yet bustling settlement of 3,000 people. The stolen money was eventually found in the Scarborough Marsh, and the thief was apprehended. Daniel D. Manley spent 12 years in prison for his crime. He was buried in the Eastern Cemetery, supposedly with the epitaph, "Portland's First Bank Robber."
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of Marshall Communications. Happy birthday, Maine!
You wonder how we got to where we are, what it means, and where we'll be tomorrow, and how what happens in other locations around our state, the country, and the world in the weeks to come will affect our lives here in Maine. You know that Maine Public Radio and NPR are there for you, an essential service in your life, keeping you up to date and helping you with the information you need, not of minor importance. Maine Public Radio will be here for you and able to do what it does because listeners like you support it financially. So do your part. It is important. Pledge support from home starting Wednesday or right now at mainepublic.org. And thanks.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. We're discussing the status and outlook for museums in Maine. My guests, Bernard Fishman with the Maine State Museum and Julie Pizzino with the Children's Museum and Theater of Maine. You can join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. tweet at Maine Calling or go to our Facebook page. And in case you didn't know, Maine Public offers an easy way to access museums across Maine. You can go to mainepublic.org to find the Maine Museum Portal with a map and links to all sorts of museums and sites across the state. Calling in now, Amy Lent, who is Executive Director of the Maine Maritime Museum. Thanks for calling in, Amy.
Hey, happy to be here. Thanks so much for the opportunity.
How long were you closed during COVID, and what did you offer during that time?
Well, we closed end of March, and we opened on June 1st. I think we were one of the first museums in the state, actually, to open completely, as soon as it was possible in our region to do so. While we were closed, we did what, you know, so many other organizations are doing. We were well positioned with a lot of our collection already digitized. So we created some really exciting exhibits on Google Arts and Culture. In fact, I think we are the only museum in the state of Maine that has their entire painting or any of their painting collection available on Google Arts and Culture. So we created some really exciting exhibits. Our curator, chief curator, Chris Tim, is very innovative, and so there's some great stuff online. We worked with all the schools. We basically took every single type of school program we could and created online formats for it. But our focus always was on opening the very minute we were able to do that, and with an idea towards not focusing so much on what we can't do, but on what we can do. Katie Spiridakis, who's our marketing manager, refused to permit any what she called pandemic language. So everything was more about, everyone knows what the issues are. You know, we don't have to keep putting in people's faces that there's this horrible virus and, you know, it's scary, rather taking the opportunity to, change things up. And if we can't do a hands-on thing, we can do a video that you can scan on your phone. If we have to close the bathrooms, we are talking about quarantining aboard ships. So things like that. The whole thing, everything we've done was towards creating an experience for visitors that would not be negative, but rather fun and positive.
Amy, your museum already has the advantage of having a significant outdoor component. How have you made the most of that for visitors?
Well, we did something that we wanted to do for a long time, and I think a lot of other folks are saying the same. It's an opportunity to focus on different things, and we created a lot of outdoor demos. So, shipbuilding related demonstrations that happen outdoors at a very safe physical distance between the volunteer and the visitors. So we're able to create some, rather than maybe hands-on type things that visitors can do, you can watch someone, for example, working at the forge in the blacksmith exhibit or working on a spar or, caulking, some different types of things that we haven't always had as live exhibits. Now we have converted those experiences into live demonstrations that you can watch from a safe distance.
Great. Well, thanks so much for calling in. That's Amy Lent, Executive Director of the Maine Maritime Museum. We also have a message here from Peter, who says he's a board member at Sail Power and Steam Museum in Rockland. He says, amid the gloom, we are thriving with a major building expansion and new sailing program. Sailing is free to kids with morning and afternoon sessions. Teachers are from Outward Bound, and their enthusiasm is only surpassed by kids and Captain Jim Sharp, who started the program to get kids on the water. In support of our good work, we just received a restored 1937 yacht, which is currently cruising the Penobscot, those same waters where Captain Jim founded the windjammer business in the 1960s. So many messages coming in. If you are not able to get your message on the air this hour, please go to the Maine Calling Facebook post today and put information about your museum onto one of the comments. We'll go to David calling from the Farnsworth Art Museum. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hi there, Jennifer. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Of course. Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to mention, after we had to close, obviously, on the 16th and tried to turn around on a dime and get some virtual content out there on the 19th of March, what we've discovered here with such a small staff is really a whole new way of creating online content and sharing with our visitors throughout the state through our e-blasts. We've actually found that we've been able to reach a much larger a group of interested parties in what is obviously one of the most remote states in the country. So we're trying to find a silver lining in all this. Of course, we're incredibly excited that we were able to reopen on June 25th, but we have been able to reach thousands of people that we perhaps would not have been able to reach in person in the same period of time.
Well, David, thanks for calling in and good luck this summer. I want to go to a very brief question from Facebook. Seth says, how is the Great Black Hawk at the State Museum? Bernard?
It's doing very well, and it looks beautiful, and it's heartbreaking that people can't see it in person. It was only on display for a few days before the veil came down, but we are going to go into it in greater detail on our website, and there is at least some possibility that we might make it available to some institution for temporary display outside of the museum. But it really looks grand, and it is a fine thing to see, so something worth waiting for, I think.
An email here from Bruce. The History Trust is a collective of independent organizations that work in partnership to, hold on just a second, I can't see it. Oh, darn. Well, anyway, the Mount Desert Island Region's historical collections, to scan the Mount Desert Island's region's historical collections and make them accessible to the whole community now and in the future. Key to accessibility, particularly relevant in the time of COVID, is digital archive, where museums, libraries, and historical societies share their documents, photos, objects, and stories with the online community. Bruce says, go to historytrust.org for more details. And Bruce, thank you for that. I also would recommend Maine Memory Net if you want to fritter away hours looking at fascinating old photos. Either one will do the trick for you. We're going to go to Dan, who's calling in from the Bates College Museum of Art. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how are you?
Good, go ahead.
Well, just a little report from the museum here. As an institution that's part of a parent institution, you know, Bates College closed campus to the public and then closed in March. So obviously the museum did as well. And sure, many of the same things that have been discussed. It has given us time with a small staff to focus on some projects that tomorrow's deadlines always seemed to eclipse. And I'm happy to say that we have a new and really expanded database available and accessible to the public. And we've just launched a much richer website, which has a lot of educational and cultural information on it. The challenges, Bates will be closed except to the campus community this fall anyway, which if you connect the dots means that the museum will not be open to people who aren't on campus. So big challenge for us. We serve a huge audience off campus and a K-12 area schools, and are moving towards a lot of educational and kind of engaging programs that will be online, including challenges, et cetera. So I encourage people to look at that. But one of our biggest challenges is we're excited to announce that we'll be having an Ashley Bryan exhibition this fall called, appropriately, Let's Celebrate Ashley Bryan, who, as we know, just turned 97, is one of the great children's book illustrators, has lived on and off in Maine since the 40s. He's also an amazing painter, which has been an overlooked part of his oeuvre, and we'll have a number of his paintings, and I'm happy to say this is all or mostly work that is part of a recent gift to the museum. We aspire to really develop a significant collection of Ashley's.
Dan, when will that be?
Well, the show will open in October, but it won't be open to the public.
So will you keep it up until the public is able to come? Will it stay hanging until that wonderful day when you can reopen?
Because no one knows when that is, I can't answer that. It will be a long exhibition. It will be open into mid-March. It will not be the first Ashley Bryan exhibition we do. If it turns out that campus is not open to the public. We will do a more in-depth and scholarly exhibition at a future date. This exhibition is really to celebrate Ashley while he's mm-hmm. here with us. And but, you know, paradoxically, it's a great show for children, and they can't come to the museum.
Dan, thank you so much for calling in from the Bates College Museum of Art. I'm going to read a post from Niles on Facebook. The Maine Discovery Museum has been partnering with Good Shepherd Food Bank to help deliver meals and are providing educational materials as part of that. In addition, we've worked with the Bangor schools and are offering for anyone an online educational resource called 100 Days of Steamy Summer. And STEAM is S period T period E period A period M period Y. So thanks for that, Niles. And also on Facebook, here at History Live Northeast, we are busy creating a mobile museum exhibit on the evolution of European arms and armor to bring to schools, and have had to pivot to live streaming presentations and online exhibits. Our first online mini exhibit, The Evolution of the Medieval Helmet, is set to come out this October. So just about a minute left, Julie, and I want to ask you if all of this has made you think differently about the role of the Children's Museum and museums generally in our culture.
Oh my gosh, absolutely. And I have to say, it's opened my eyes to arts and culture in our community and how critically important it is, even just personally in my own life. I mean, our arts and culture industry just here in Maine contributes $12 billion annually to the economy. We employ one in six Maine workers, so close to 100,000 jobs that we create and provide. So just the interlacing of that work with the rest of our lives and our work here in Maine, I think, is so critical. And, you know, we as museums and as arts and culture organizations in general, we exist in many ways to create joy and to bring people together and to ensure that we provide unique and creative ways for people, adults, kids, to experience the world. And I think that need has only been more greatly seen as a result of this pandemic. We will get back to a normal. It might be a new normal, but the need for museums, the need for arts and culture organizations, I think, is just keenly illustrated by the struggles of the pandemic. And I look forward to a time, hopefully in the near future, when we're all back together in a more regular way.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. My guest for the hour, Julie Pizzino, Executive Director of the Children's Museum and Theater of Maine, and Bernard Fishman, Director of the Maine State Museum. Stay with us for today's briefing with Maine CDC Director Nirav Shah. That's on Maine Public Radio, television, Facebook, and on our website. Sandra Harris ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.